This is a podcast on local government and devolution with Neil Stewart in conversation with Professor Tony Travis of the London School of Economics, Bob Pritchard from Eversheds, and Adam Feinberg, a consultant and journalist in local government. Welcome to all of you. I wanted just to start off by saying that it's very interesting how quick this government has been out of the trap on the issue of not just devolution in Scotland, but the Northern powerhouse. Now, is this necessary political expediency after the shock of the general election, or is this finally the start of a big trend towards more devolution, more localism across the whole of the country? Tony, I'll come to you first. You and I have watched this from the time when Michael Heseltine was a small boy, right through all of it. Are the stars all lined up in the Conservative Party for change?
Well, I think what's most interesting about this is that George Osborne has decided, and this started before the general election, so this is something that continues from the latter days of the coalition. But George Osborne had obviously decided, for a number of reasons, some of them political, some of them for devolution and sort of England, sorting out the England question reasons, that the time had come to invest more effort in trying to rebuild the economies, particularly the urban north. Now, he's a Northern MP. There aren't that many Conservative MPs in the north before the general election, and I think he'd realised that the Conservative Party has for many years been doing badly in the urban north, and so there was a political imperative for a Conservative Chancellor to show that the Conservative Party had something to offer the north. Beyond that, there is a powerful argument, which I think people in London and the South sort of share, if they're rational, which is that there needs to be some rebalancing of the economy, not by levelling down, but by levelling up. And in that sense, that message is also inside all of this. But then there is the third question, the issue of what about devolution in England? Because at the moment, lots of concentration, as you say, on Scotland. Wales is also getting extra powers, and even some for Northern Ireland. So, you know, before we go off down the complex territory of an English Parliament or English votes for English laws, all of which, you know, disaster lies all around them, I would guess, a much easier way of creating some balance within the UK would be to give England some form of devolution. And it's no longer going to be regions. The last government effectively destroyed the idea of regions in England by losing that northeast referendum in 2004. So what we're now left with is an evolved Greater Manchester city regional bid, which, you know, along with the London model, is now in some ways a template for city region plus directly elected mayor, but particularly allowing Osborne to hand power to, or more power to, northern cities. It's a start, but that, I think, is how it's come about.
So there's a political imperative, Bob, a growth imperative. How genuine do you think all the language is, and are the stars lining up to facilitate growth in the Leeds and the Manchester and the other big?
Well, the big cities in the north have been sort of campaigning for this sort of agenda for a long time. And so I think, the advantage of this approach as well is it's based on economic geography. I mean, Tony's mentioned the problems with the regions, and the problem with the regions didn't make any sense economically. So it makes a lot of sense for Leeds and Manchester to have growth delivered on a city region basis. Again, by making sure that the planning system actually delivers along city region lines, having proper spatial planning for city regions will help unlock growth, undoubtedly.
So, a growth ambition. Economic and finance ambition. This is a government that plans to tie its hands on national taxation, at least promising not to put up taxes. But of course, taxes are not the same as other forms of revenue. Just back to you, Tony. What are the revenue streams that might be unlocked during this Parliament, the ones that haven't been touched since Mrs. Thatcher walked the earth?
Well, I mean, it's true that in England, and of course the UK government in this regard is operating only in England because the Scots are about to be given extraordinary powers to set their own taxes in a way that I think will have profound impacts, but we can discuss those perhaps on another day. Within England, we're still living in a world where the Treasury, which you know always gets back after general elections, the Treasury still believes in the need to control taxes. And you know, we live in a very unusual country. In England, 100% of taxes are set by national government. If you take the little bit that's council tax, that's all capped and frozen. So, you know, we live in a very unusual country. However, there's no question that some of the city regions, London, Greater Manchester, are looking for the possibility of greater freedom to set their own taxes, or at least to capture the growth in the tax base. And the Greater Manchester Earn Back deal, rather like the reforms to business rate, do allow councils now to capture some of the growth that comes with their economic success. And in fact, it's going to be 100% in Greater Manchester and Greater Cambridge, albeit over a threshold. So I think what this is also going to do is to generate an argument in the city regions about how perhaps they can get greater tax raising or indeed powers to charge. Because I mean, separately to everything we're discussing today is the fact that local government finance is being drained away quickly as a result of the need to reduce the deficit by cutting public spending. And so, you know, there is going to have to be other reform that allows local government, which is the basis of these city regions, to find a way of providing the resources to deliver the services which will create the growth, or at least help create the growth.
In the think tank world, the sort of co-funding, co-production agenda where individuals, I mean, talking previously about care and social care, of course the big exercise around Dilnot has stalled. And now we're seeing the release of lots of people's lifetime capital with the new changes to pensions. Is any of that going to go into local economies, or is it just hoping that it'll trickle down?
I think there's that money, I think it's rather, you know, insofar as anybody knows what's going to happen with it, I think it's probably in the realms of trickle down rather than in being applied to any public purpose. But you know, the question of how these city regions fund what they do, if it isn't to be tax raising or other revenue raising powers, is going to come down also to the question of what other public spending can be devolved to them. And of course, before the election, George Osborne was talking about the possibility of some form of health service transfer to Greater Manchester. Of course, once you set off down that road, you could devolve, let us say, the NHS to subnational government. That's enormously radical. And you can see from a Conservative government's point of view, potentially a double win, because on the one hand it's devolutionary, and on the other hand it would leave the Labour Party not knowing quite how to react to it, given that it controls most of the big cities.
And indeed the Labour Party has been completely tied in knots by that.
It has.
So the figure that's being bandied around for devolving health services in Manchester is £6 billion just in that area, and that compares to £4 billion for the whole of England when the public health function was transferred after the last election. So the scale of that is a very radical, and that would certainly match his radical credentials.
If, and I stress if, because you know it would depend how it was done, but if there were an agreement effectively to transfer what you might call the governmental responsibility for health services and their funding to, let us say, the Greater Manchester City region, that would be one of the most profound reforms to have occurred to British public policy since 1945, because it would herald, if it happened, stress, the beginning of the breakup of the NHS in England. Now, that has happened, of course, in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland already, although it still badged the NHS. They are separate systems. This would be a profound, if it happened, would be a profound change.
Now, Adam, you're a bit more sceptical about these kinds of reforms, that's not really, they can make changes to that Devo Manc level if they want, but that's not really the direction to go. Just say a bit about your feelings on that?
There's obviously there's a planning and spatial planning and housing allocation by region and infrastructural investment and planning and development around transport. There's a strong case to be made for strengthening regional and sub-regional structures or putting them in place with that in mind. And there's absolutely no doubt about that. And we've been lacking that tier of planning, we can call it, in the UK for a good amount of time, and we've seen regional targets around housing scrapped and so on in the last coalition government. So in terms of supporting regional growth and sub-regional growth and ensuring the skills are in place, that places are connected and so on, there's no doubt that there's an important role for the development of a regional, sub-regional planning framework and infrastructure that has some kind of democratic basis and linkage. And that can most definitely help relieve the stresses, the pressures on the southeast, the overheating. We hear the property prices going up more and more in London. We know that the Treasury are very, very concerned about growth and the potential for growth in UK PLC when we haven't got that balanced growth. And we've seen the interventions in the last 3 years where we wouldn't have otherwise seen them. We've seen HS2, etc. There's been some concerns about HS2 just expanding the travel to work area for the southeast, London southeast, rather than spreading it to the north. So I think in a way, a lot of this work around the northwest, following the tracks in Northern Way, working with partners in the northwest politically and administratively who could been shown to deliver and are strong and have the capacity, there's a clear argument and understanding around why the government might want to do something like this. If we look at things like health and we look at public service reform and improvement and efficiencies on the front line for the services that we're delivering to citizens, so we're talking about people-based services here, and building people's resilience and helping them get a leg up and find their own ways. If we look at health, we've seen the reforms over the last few years to CCGs, commissioning groups, the commissioner-provider split, and we've got that infrastructure there already. Some of it is not coterminous at all with local authorities. So in Manchester, we're going to have the PCT map overlaid over the 10 local authority maps, and that's going to be complicated in itself. That's true that we have, I think, 10 authorities of the same political colour, so that will help. And we have 10 health and wellbeing boards of the same colour, therefore. But I don't think we've got coterminosity in terms of CCGs. Now, if all that's going to really happen, I think that's the case on the back of the reforms in the last parliament, is that we're going to have a new committee, a new tier, above the 10 local authorities across the municipal area, which coordinates all the work of all the health and wellbeing boards and the CCGs, then actually, in reality, I think we're going to get a fudge and we're not going to get any improved outcomes or very tailored local work. And my experience actually is that if we're looking at improved outcomes and realising the efficiencies, we have to focus at a local authority level or lower where people are working to localities or neighbourhoods.
There is a delivery management argument around that, but interestingly, George Osborne insists that there's an elected mayor. Mm. Now, do you think that local authorities and others understand why he is so insistent on that? If I look back through the Blair period when local authorities didn't opt for mayors, there was a lot of decisions that weren't taken. These mayors are not there to wave flags and greet the Queen. They're there to take the difficult decisions on planning, on transport, where things cross boundaries. They're there to carry consent and in some cases probably overrule the committees and drive them. Now, you know, do you think people understand why he is sticking to saying there must be an executive authority?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I was at Leeds when they rejected the idea of a city mayor, but the city region mayor is different. I mean, it is. I think there's a case for having an executive that makes decisions on that bigger scale, because otherwise you end up with having to have a consensus between all the authorities and ending up with a sort of lowest common denominator outcome. And so therefore that is the other difference is also the additional functions that the city region elected mayor would have as well. So and there's been criticism already of the Manchester spatial plan, Manchester being first to do it. that it lacks vision, because again, there has to be an element of consensus in there to persuade all the political leaders to actually sign up to it. So I think there is a justification for having that city region executive function just so that those difficult decisions can be made. And planning is often about making difficult decisions. Where should housing go? Where should growth go? What are the functions of different towns and cities within city regions? And somebody needs to make those decisions and have that accountability.
If I may, I totally think that's the case. I mean, in London, we've been talking earlier about London and the GLA and Transport for London and everything that's been done. Maybe it was almost a single purpose vehicle for actually doing something about state of public transport in London. What were developments around Docklands and so on, and linking into transport infrastructure. TfL enabled that to all happen. And what's more, it was the government's oversight of that and direction on that, but it wasn't meddling or interfering with any of the individual boroughs and their activities. I think in the case of Manchester, we've got 10 local authorities and possibly other areas as well. We're trying to create some kind of leadership model, which I'm all in favour of, some kind of mayoral model, but only in cases where they don't go against or try to intervene or try to create some kind of consensus over authorities' actions below them, where there isn't a unique political colour, an agreed agenda.
I have sat round tables having these arguments for almost as long as Tony has. One of the figures I always throw back at people is we have this local authority structure. Tony could remind me. Around the 1951 census, there's a figure that 68% of men used to go home for their lunch. Travel to work areas where people live, where they work, where they identify with, where they're prepared to give their consent to. No longer follows anything that people would recognise as existing local government boundaries. If you ask people where they live in Manchester, you quite often find out they live in Salford. If you ask Birmingham, you discover that they're next to the airport in Solihull.
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, and at some level, the United Kingdom, I don't really literally mean this, you know, it would obviously be better if it were differently laid out, you know, or in different size or something, or the Industrial Revolution had happened differently. And we are left with complex geographies below the national level, and particularly in the Midlands and the north of England, where there are some real hurdles to get over, hurdles that have to do with the way the cities were laid out during the Industrial Revolution in the north, and the way Birmingham and the Black Country relate to each other. For example, in the West Midlands and in the East Midlands, you've got a series of medium-sized cities and so on, without, you know, big metropolitan area around them. So trying to find any system that works is going to be hard. And that's why I think that the now consensus agreement that this is a bottom-up process, and whatever the Greater Manchester arrangement is indeed bottom-up. So in that sense, all 10 of the districts have signed up to it. But then there is this paradoxical problem that if you want to go beyond that, and this is to answer your question, I think, Neil, is that the, you know, ministers think, well, we need a powerful person like us, you know, somebody that I, the Prime Minister, can say hello to when I go up there and feel that this is the person who's in charge, as I would with a big company. Now, and of course, that is quite threatening to all the individual leaders. And it does mean, and this is the paradox of citywide government, is that even if you were sent to it at the beginning, one of the things it will have to do is occasionally to drive through changes that individual areas or people in them don't want. And you can see this very clearly in London. As London's population grows, there's no question if there's going to be much more housing, it's going to require the mayor from time to time to override the boroughs, or at least a borough and the people who live in it, for the greater good. And once you say that, in a system like Greater Manchester or the Leeds city region that's come together voluntaristically, that is threatening. So, you know, it requires people of goodwill to make good decisions to make it work.
And the ability to carry the consent.
And it does require us consent and accountability.
And that's my point about geographies and doing the right thing at the right scale, and where it works and where it fits with the legacy that we have in terms of the organisation of local government. as I mentioned, you know, in terms of infrastructural planning and regional planning for growth, I think certainly there's an important role for regional, sub-regional bodies to play in that as the lead actors with a strong, clear leader. And also, and what we haven't mentioned, is the one-stop shop for the private sector to go to speak to somebody, a significant clout to draw investment and spread growth around the country. And that's been wholly lacking for a very, very long time in this country. And that very clearly explains, well, a good reason to explain why we have regional economies dominated by public sector employment that has seen significant failures in terms of regional economics in the last downturn. And we've seen other areas like the Southeast doing very well, thank you. Now, the point is that if we are going to introduce some kind of a regional or sub-regional apparatus around infrastructural development and growth, that's all well and good, but then we need to, in my view, and it can be a bottom-up process, but not in a way that led to a bottom-up process, but it can be a bottom-up process in terms of collaborative arrangements between local authorities that are made to work, and they bang their own heads together, they make it work politically, they make it work in terms of economic development, travel to work areas, etc., what they think are the right patterns and what they know of their own economies. But if we're talking, as Sir Richard Lewis is talking, of actually taking on huge empires to deliver all public services in a metropolitan area, I say that's far from the suitable role for that tier, that level, that geography. Because as I say again, the vast number of public services which are human focused, people focused, are at the local authority level, and actually by introducing yet another tier does nothing to help that at all.
But there is although the fronts of local authorities and the fronts of the town halls, many of them still look the same, behind them are these vast shadow, and I don't mean that negatively, organisations like Capita and Serco and a whole range of others who are supporting the infrastructure for whole clusters of organisations, sometimes at opposite ends of the country. So what we thought of as local authorities and working in a set place and going home for lunch 20, 30, 40 years ago, I mean, a lot of that is gone already for all the back office staff and others. For the front office staff, when we look at health services and other things, it's running off mobile devices and the ability to make the leap into the technology. And surely, again, in an age of austerity, there's some of that scale may facilitate.
If I may go back to the health and situation, give a case study. I've been working with a CCG and a coterminous unitary authority in the Northeast that I won't name. And I've been advising them in accordance with the 5-year view and developing a bid for new ways of working to develop health services for the area. Now, the problem they have, because the infrastructure is built up around the health economies, and particularly regional health economies, is that although they can work together across the local authority and CCG in terms of health and social care integration, and they know their needs of their population and hope to design provision accordingly, the actual infrastructure around procurement, and it's not commissioning, it's procurement in health, is actually at the regional level because that's the way it's all been redesigned. So it's been designed so that people can procure health services at a regional level, but they can't ensure that that procurement meets the specific needs and requirements in that very local authority area. And that's the way that it's been set up on the health front. And what you're talking about is all the other services, and actually, in a way, the extent of your argument is that all those public services that might be going out to capital at the moment or in the future, if we look at commissioning, regional commissioning or metropolitan or devolutionary authorities for commissioning these services at a wider level, then maybe that replicates what's happening already in health.
So, on some of those types of services, perhaps in health and social care, Devo Manc could turn out to be a step too far. It could be the step they trip on. But on planning and housing and transport?
Actually, I think that rang a bell with me on planning, because one of the big issues on planning is what level is the planning done? We've got neighbourhood plans, we've got local plans, and we're going to have regional plans. And so there's going to be a bit of a debate about what is a regional planning issue, what is a neighbourhood plan. There's already a debate about what is a neighbourhood planning issue and what is a local planning issue. So that is not an easy issue to actually resolve.
It's the function of a mayor not to say, look, sort this out or I'll overrule you. Well, because there are incentives are lacking for people to sort themselves out if they think they can appeal all the way up to.
But there needs to be clarity about that intervention and when that intervention should actually happen, so that needs to be clear. Otherwise, it's a recipe for disaster.
One of the things that it is different. In the northeast is different because in some ways there is the vestige of the region lives on in the northeast, despite what I was saying at the very beginning. So actually, the northeast still thinks of itself in a sort of regional city-regional way, which is different to most of England. We'll come on to Scotland. We need to mention Scotland and Wales as too, I think, in a moment as well, because there are analogous moves there too. So I think that what's interesting about the city-regional movement, if we can call it that, in England, is that, of course, as in London, London was the last place left with a planning, as a city-wide, regional, as it used to be called, city-wide, I would call it, planning function. And so these reforms do bring back at least the idea of city-regional planning, which, after all, you know, for those with a very long memory, takes us back to, you know, proposals that were made in the late 60s and early 70s, when there were discussions about reforming government at that time. But just to add a little bit, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Glasgow and Cardiff, or the area around Cardiff, southeast Wales, are also evolving analogous, you know, proposals. And it's interesting that Glasgow has been part of the city deal process of the UK government. So, in a sense of, despite all the radical changes to Scotland's government, hasn't stopped Glasgow and Cardiff from being members now of the Core Cities Group and actually thinking more like, well, alongside, I should say, the cities in England, that they want more freedom inside Scotland and Wales, which I think is just worth noting, really, that, you know, it's not as if devolution to Scotland and Wales means there's no need for subnational devolution inside each of those nations.
Just going back to money and this question of where other revenue streams might come, if the government is going to close the door on some of the national taxation sources. You know, in the past, people have looked at things around leisure taxes on hotels, all the activity around conferences and events. People have looked at land value taxes of, you know, that there is some share in the value of rising assets, all sorts of charging mechanisms. You know, I mean, the number of stories that people tell at the moment about simple things like parking charges and how important they've become to everybody, not just Westminster. But a question, Tony, you might have a bit of an answer on this, is that how the size of assets that local authorities are sitting on that are not currently either in play or leveraged. A number of years ago, working on an asset conference with a magazine, the figure was 254 billion on the asset registers of local authorities. Now, not all liquid, and a few of it will be Lowry paintings and others that have been sold off. The Treasury and George Osborne and others are not blind to that and what might be mobilised. So in those kind of areas of money, charging, tax base, if you had to predict what were the things that would come into play in this Parliament, even if they didn't wisely start until the Parliament afterwards, where do you think people should watch?
Well, I think, I mean, especially given we're sitting in, you know, one of the country's leading lawyers who do lots of work in this regard, one of the things that will definitely happen is as local government resources are reduced, it will, where it is possible, create a far greater demand, even than in the past, to use development and the gains that can be made with development through, you know, community infrastructure levy and, you know, whether any Section 106 left after all of that, but those kind of deals as a way of a form of tax. You know, we do tax, this is all just a way of taxing rising land values, and of course it's much easier to do this where land values are high and rising, but it can be done in other places as well. So I think that, you know, this is going to put a further premium on very large developments wherever possible at high densities in order to extract the maximum from them. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that where it's possible. But you raise other interesting questions. I mean, the other place where I think we're going to see action is that we'll see the evolution of more business improvement districts. Business improvement districts allow businesses effectively to volunteer to tax themselves a bit more, and that means you can get a bit more business rate to start to use for purposes of, frankly, keeping town centres and city centres clean and tidy in a way that will be less easy as these resources drain away. And I know bids weren't intended to be like this originally, and now we're going to get property owners' bids, I think. I'm not an expert on this, you know, a new way of raising money from owners as well as occupiers. And then lastly, you know, will we see a move to more permissive local taxation? Well, we might. I mean, the new minister, Greg Clark, is very different to his predecessor. And with that in mind, I mean, the possibility that the Treasury might lighten up, at least the point of allowing some new small revenues like a tourism tax that councils could choose to use if they wanted to. This would be very useful to cities and city regions because they tend to have large numbers of hotels, and Birmingham was considering a tourism. Birmingham Solihull had a tourism bid at one point. So I think in that's where I'd look to first, nothing too radical, but that's where I'd look to first, that kind of area.
And anything on the community charge and housing, even if it is stretched out beyond 2020, that revenue base around housing property?
Do you mean in terms of the sale of the assets?
Well, no, raising more money from the people who occupy rent. Their houses. And
well, I think social, I mean, you know, there's several further discussions of this kind on another day about, you know, we've got to right to buy for housing associations, the impact that's going to have on local authorities' requirement to sell off assets in order to produce money, both to pay off the housing associations and build new housing. Another day, I suspect. Yeah. Complicated. I think, in a sense, the use of local government assets, use of public sector assets more generally, I mean, you'd have to be very optimistic not to think too many negatives here. The public sector could undoubtedly use its asset base better. Of course it could. One of the real benefits of PFI deals was that where they occurred, they could force the public sector to think through everything it owned. I mean, even if the PFI deal wasn't the best one ever, it did make them think through everything they owned, how it could be brought back into use and used as part of the deal. So I do think that the, you know, not just social housing, but the wider property ownership, and not just of local government, is a ripe field for common sense rationalisation, asset sales, reuse of resources, but particularly, you know, allowing, you know, public sector to, and this is not true only of capital but of revenue, we're talking about this in the context of health and social care, there's just going to have to be more pooling of resources to produce rational decisions about public services.
And will we see the return of any of the big society in that? I recall at the start of the last Parliament, while the great fanfare was going on about the big society, most local authority chief executives were very quickly moving on the things that they could change, outsourcing, how many people were due to retire and come off the payroll in the next period, non-replacement, you know, good solid traditional levers. Assuming that they've used quite a lot of them, do we think that we're going to see new kinds of social enterprises or co-funding or cooperation, or is all of that going to flounder again? Go on, Adam, you.
Well, I think, you know, the role of social capital, community investment companies, employee buyouts, open public services white paper, all of that was meant quite rightly to recognise the great value of the work that's undertaken, in a sense informally, if we're talking about local government in the community. And one of the things I mentioned going around is talking about children's centres, for example, is actually they've displaced a lot of the activity that was in the social sector, the social capital, terms of parent and toddler groups and village halls and so on, and the local networks and self-support and so on. And a lot of that has gone because of the in very good investment in many respects into children's centres, and as particularly as a result of the services that came out of those children's centres. But the unintended consequence is the impact on the local provision within the community. And the thing is about big societies, obviously we all know the messaging the expectation on citizens to provide a service, the way that it was all put forward was wrong, and it wasn't a positive, constructive thing. And the other thing we know, and we know that will continue, is that actually this value and recognition of social capital was all in the control of local authorities. It was for them to decide to what extent they were going to commission or develop the role of or support the capacity of the third sector to provide the services. And we know, particularly in a period where there's austerity coming, that people, of course, are protecting their own budgets, their own roles, their own fiefdoms and their own activities. And I think that's quite clearly why, despite all of this good rhetoric, including by council leaders, are about the role of the community sector, we haven't seen that shift. And I must also just wish to say, as I recall, in the early 90s, we had a similar movement and shift, I think, around health and caring, that we're going to let the third sector do it all. And that's where we developed a lot of the organisations that became very professional, became very good at bidding. They were, in fact, business organisations, but with the tax benefits of being a charity. And as soon as the cuts came in after that cycle, they were all cut down dead. And all of that voluntarism, that good ethos and the public citizens was lost. And Cameron was in effect trying to reenact that and restart that, and I'm not sure it worked. And whether until we change this power balance in terms of putting the money in the local authority or other public service hands to decide upon the extent to which they commission third sector organisations, whether we're going to get that actual engagement.
Okay. Just on a last point then, do you think we'll ever see the time when George Osborne or anybody can say to people in London, you know, go north, young man or young woman, in the way that perhaps in America they would have said go west? And what would make people go north? What would make people go Manchester, Leeds, etc.? What's already there that would make them go further? Tony, what would make people go north, business or people?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the major cities of the north and the Midlands are in a vastly better position now than they were 15 or 20 years ago, that the efforts of successive governments, it's really started under Mrs. Thatcher's government, new Labour government, spent a great deal of time and money on this, and you know the present government's carried this forward in a slightly different way with city regions and city deals and so on. And I mean, so you know, I think that what the major cities elsewhere in the UK offer is that they do give you all the benefits of big city life, but often with lower housing costs and, you know, potentially, depending on your tastes, a different quality of life which you might think is better. Now, other people will always make the opposite, you know, choice. I mean, the thing about London is it's just its epic scale. I mean, you know, it is just epically bigger than the other cities, however you configure them. And that's an accident of history. You know, it's not, so it doesn't make them, London or Manchester or Leeds or Glasgow, better or worse each than the other. They're just different. So they offer different things. But I think what we will see is that, you know, many international companies want to come into London, but lots of companies in Britain can make rational decisions about where they put their staff, as you can get around the UK very easily because it's so small. And you know, I do think that the opportunities for big cities in Britain, you know, are better than they've ever been. And so one element of that is, you know, you can hear some of the rural authorities beginning to think they're getting, and they are certainly in the public debate, slightly getting left behind. Now, that wouldn't have been thought possible in the not so distant past when, you know, the rural parts of the country were increasingly richer and richer, more and more people moving there. Now the cities have, to some extent, got the, you know, got a bit of a go-ahead. So I think that there's plenty of opportunity for all. I mean, remember, in the 19th century, all these cities grew at once. It's not a zero-sum game.
Adam, how would you advise somebody to go north?
Well, having just recently come back from France and visited Bordeaux and seeing what the mayor Juppé has managed to do with Bordeaux and the money going in there, we know about Toulouse and aerospace, and we know about Montpellier and the mayor and his excesses around architecture in the public realm, but what that's managed to do for the city. And in terms of the mixture of the components of the local economy that create wealth regionally and contribute to the growth of the whole country, we see a very different picture in the UK, and we know there are lots of cultural reasons for that. there are lots of reasons around centralisation as well as regionalisation and planning and transport activities. But there is something about this neglect. I mean, we have seen a lot of new apartments, inner city apartments in Leeds and in Manchester and elsewhere. And that's been in the back of the property bubble and the rising market. And Tony mentioned the rising market earlier in terms of property and the opportunities to lever in further funding for activities. But what we haven't seen so much, apart from service jobs, maybe places like Leeds and Manchester, which actually tend to be second tier functions, head sort of value added functions, creative steering leadership functions are still in London and South East. So we've got urban centres developing around the UK and much to offer, of course, and a lot of potential. And that's the problem, is that the UK has been left as a free market in terms of planning and development and investment since the 70s. And not saying it all was rose in the 70s and industrial location certificates and so on, but they had their role in helping to ensure there was some kind of balanced growth across the country and that every region could develop and offer its lot.
Okay. Well, people in business, Bob, how would you lure them up to Leeds and Manchester?
Speaking as somebody who's born in Bradford and has worked in Leeds and Bradford, I can't believe that they aren't coming now, to be honest with you. But I mean, there's an issue about cities articulating what they can offer. And I mean, Leeds is often accused of being a bit too shy about what it can offer as a city. And I think, again, it's back to spatial planning. If cities can articulate what their particular offer is, within the Northern Powerhouse, then that would help enormously. Transport is a key issue as well. The HS3 model, I mean, the idea that you know, Manchester and Leeds are so close together and yet it takes so long. So, I mean, you know, it is, I mean, okay, there's the Pennines in the way, but improving transport links has got to be key to making the cities outside London more attractive.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Bob Pritchard, Adam and Tony Travis. No doubt we're on a roller coaster after the launch of the Northern Powerhouse and other reforms to come. Perhaps we'll see the day when people are nostalgically putting up pictures of Eric Pickles in their local authority. But we'll return to this again, no doubt, after the budget. Thank you, all three of you.